This is Ronald Coleman, inviting you to radio's most dramatic half hour, Favorite Story. Favorite Story invites you to hear a story discovery. It was found on a London bookstall by Jerome Robbins, the young choreographer who did such brilliant work in the Broadway hits On the Town, High Button Shoes, and Look Ma, I'm Dancing. Robbins thought this yarn so unusual that he immediately sent us a copy and named it his favorite story. A half dozen cables have sped back and forth across the Atlantic to obtain the rights to dramatize this strange tale. So, for all of you who like your narratives on the startling side, here's John Keir Cross's The Glass Eye. Things that are funny so that you laugh at them. And there are things that are funny, but you don't laugh at them at all. You can take, for example, the case of Julia. Is it possible to laugh at people like Julia? I've never been able to. Yet Julia is funny. There's something funny in that gaunt shape, in those wide and earnest eyes, and the red, moist tip of that nose of hers that seems longer than any nose in the world. Julia is over 40, 42 to be exact. A friend of mine, a man who makes up verse for the magazines, wrote a poem about Julia. He called it To Julia, a song for a lost, mad girl. And it went like this. Oh, she thought she was in China and a million miles away, all among the tall pagodas where the shining geishas play. And the mockingbirds were singing and the lanterns burning red, and the temple bells were ringing softly, softly in her head. Now, Julia isn't really mad, just strange. You'd be strange, too, if you led the life Julia leads. I want you to hear a story about Julia. Since most of what happened is so terribly personal, let's climb the stairs to Julia's dusky little flat and sit down next to her, as if we weren't even there, and try to listen to what goes on inside her head.
It didn't happen. It never happened. I might have imagined it, you know. Yet this room is real enough. The yellow wallpaper stained with damp at the corners. The washstand. The gas ring a trifle rusty. The mantel shelf with the 8-day clock. And in front of it, on a square of velvet, the glass eye, his glass eye, as real as anything else in the room. No, I mustn't look at it. I mustn't keep it there as a terrible reminder. Why? It's the only memory I have. The only memory. It started late one summer. It was warm in London. I was working for Mr. Mofrey, a solicitor. I remember turning on my stool and waiting until he had finished writing a sentence in a law brief. Mr. Mofrey.
Yes, Miss Benson?
Would you mind, Mr. Mofrey, if I left about 20 minutes early this afternoon?
Oh? What's the special occasion, Miss Benson?
I have to meet a train. My sister's boy is coming to spend a few days with me. They live in Lister.
Oh, yes, that's the crippled lad, isn't it?
Yes, Mr. Mofrey. My sister likes to spend a bit of time visiting her husband's people in Wales. And so Bernard comes to London.
I do my best to show the poor little chap a good time.
That's very generous of you, Miss Benson. What sort of things do you do to amuse the lad?
I take him to the cinema. I buy him a toy. He's a quiet child. He doesn't ask for much.
Hunsaker down the hall mentioned that there was a good bill at the Old Palace Music Hall. I imagine the lad would like that. Acrobats and such. There's also a ventriloquist. One of those chaps who throws his voice.
Oh, that's a fine suggestion, Mr. Mowbray. I'll get tickets for tonight. Thank you very much, Mr. Mowbray. I met Bernard at his train. He was a very pale child, 11 years old. We had supper at the ABC tea shop. A mutton chop apiece and a large baked potato between us. It tasted good. Bernard said very little, but it was good to eat with someone else, with a guest. We went to the theater and sat in red plush stalls. There was an acrobat act, a man and a woman in white tights and spangled panties. I'm afraid I found it rather dull. Now, let me see, Bernard, what's next? Max Collodi, I guess you pronounce it. The gentleman ventriloquist with his amazing dummy, George. Oh, I think this will amuse you, Bernard. The curtain rose, and I saw him.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I and my talented little dummy here will be pleased to entertain you.
Watch out who you're calling a dummy, Max. You're not so smart yourself.
How about a song, George? A nice, smart song.
Don't mind if I do, Max, old man. Isn't he dull?
Go ahead, George.
Shoving me, Max. I'm going. There was I, awaiting at the church, awaiting at the church, awaiting at the church. This here girl, she
left. As he sat there on the stage with the spotlight on him, I knew there was no one more handsome in the whole world than Max Collodi. His dark hair gleamed, his shoulders were so broad. George, the dummy on his knee, was a grotesque doll about 3 feet high. I hardly listened to their act. I just stared and stared at the incredibly handsome young man. And I knew then that there could be no other man in all the world for me but the ventriloquist, Max Collodi. I took Bernard home as if I were in a dream. I gave him a cup of hot milk and put him to bed in a cot behind a curtain. Then I went to bed at the far side of the room. I lay for a long time staring at the ceiling, listening to the night sounds. Footsteps through the window from the street. The slow footsteps of a policeman. The strolling footsteps of lovers. Lovers. Lovers.
Oh, come on. Come on now.
And all the time I kept thinking of Max Collodi. Mrs. Max Collodi. Madame Collodi. Or is it Signora Collodi? Oh, footsteps mounting the stairs. The young man in the flat above coming home. Suppose I was Signora Collodi. Right now, I'm lying in the upper room of our villa in Italy. Max has been appearing at the theater. He's coming home now, dead tired. It's his footsteps coming up the stairs. In another moment, the door will open. He'll come in. He'll lean down and kiss me. I'll hold him very close. It is the young man upstairs. He's going into his flat. Signora Collodi. After Bernard went back to Lystra, I went to the music hall again. I prayed that Max Collodi would still be there. He was. He was. It was his last night. I sat so impatiently through the dreadful acrobat act. And then he came on. He came on. I didn't listen to his act at all. I just stared at him.
A ventriloquist, all am I. A ventriloquist, all, that's all.
And that's all you are, son.
Well, don't rub it in, man. Don't rub it in.
I didn't care what George was. It was Max, his master, I cared about. What a nice small bow he made. Such gentlemanly restraint. Bowing without standing up, with the dummy still on his knee. They were applauding him, my Max. It was impossible to believe that anybody could be so handsome. I had to see him again. I had to know where he was going from here. I bought a copy of Stage. Here it is. Finsbury next week, then Strotham, Bradford, Blackpool. Yes. Yes. I'm going to do it. Mr. Murphy.
Yes, Miss Benson.
I wish to give my notice.
Huh?
I'm leaving your service.
Leaving, Miss Benson? Whatever for? Aren't you happy here?
I must be frank with you, Mr. Murphy. I am not. I'm leaving to go with the man I'm in love with. I said that so surely, so certainly, like a young girl. Oh, but I never would have said it if I knew then what I know now. As I sit here in the room with the yellow wallpaper, looking at that hideous thing on my mantelpiece, the glass,
We're ready for Act Two of this week's favorite story. Lurene Tuttle stars as Julia in John Keir Cross's remarkable tale called The Glass Eye. Julia sits in the half-light of her room, hardly daring to look at her mantelpiece. For there, on a square of black velvet, is the glass eye.
Why did I do it? Years of loneliness, solitary meals, an ugly room with yellow wallpaper. No one to love. And then suddenly, Max Collodi. I had a small capital simply invested. I'd accumulated it through many years of saving. I drew it all out. I would live on this and follow Max Collodi around the country. Just looking at him, sitting there so handsome in the spotlight on the stage. Just looking at him was enough. I went to every performance he gave for weeks, paying my 3 shillings 6, sitting in the darkness, looking at the light. But then I felt I had to meet him. Maybe. If I were bold enough, I would even go up to him and say, Mr. Collodi, I enjoy your performance very much. And perhaps even shake his hand quickly for just a moment. At Strotham, I got up enough courage and waited at the stage entrance in the shadows.
Good night, Pop.
You're on a performance tonight. Watch those boobs out front on a window chuckle.
Two little things. See you at
I watched them all go out. The acrobat, the fat lady who rode the bicycle in the closing act. The juggler with the funny ears. But no. No Max Collodi. I waited a long time. They started to turn out all the lights. The old man at the stage door started to lock up the theater. I walked up to him slowly.
Who's that?
I beg your pardon, sir. I'm sorry to bother you.
Yes. What do you want?
I know you'll think this is very odd. But can you tell me if Max Collodi has come out yet?
You're waiting for Max Collodi?
Yes.
Well, that's a good one. She's waiting for Max Collodi.
I knew I wasn't good enough for him. People would laugh. I was old, and he was young and handsome. But even so, I wrote Max Collodi a letter. I wrote it very carefully. I told him how much I enjoyed his performance and wondered if perhaps I might be privileged to meet him. Days later, I received a reply. I tore open the letter. My dear Miss Benson, I am grateful for your praise. I regret to say, however, that I never grant interviews. Cordially yours, Max Collodi. Oh! But I kept going to his performances, and I kept on writing to him. It surprised me very much that he went on replying. And as time passed, he seemed to grow warmer in his letters, even friendly. Once in Bradford, he asked me to send him a photograph. I found a blurred snapshot of myself. In it, I appeared on a lawn against a background of fuchsia and veronica bushes, very shy, with my head to one side. It was a very old snapshot, a daylight exposure print on matte paper. People had said in those days that it was a dead spit image of me. The bobbed hair caught up in a bandeau of Japanese silk. The frock with no waist that ended above the knee. The earrings of emerald cut glass. But it was a picture of me at 23. I shouldn't have. The whole thing wouldn't have happened if I hadn't sent that picture. It was at Blackpool that I finally met Max Collodi. I'd been suggesting again and again in my letters that someday we might meet. And finally a letter came. A very special letter. I ripped it open. Dear Miss Benson, I believe that I might grant you a short interview, but we must make certain conditions. You are to stay only for 5 minutes this first time. Later on, perhaps, if you still wish to go on seeing me, we might arrange longer appointments. I wish to state at this time that I have an aversion in real life to strong light, being so much in my professional life under the glare of the lamps and the footlights. So my hotel room will be dimly lit. If you do not mind being received in a half-lit hotel bedroom by a strange man with no other chaperone beside my dummy, George. My. Then would you come to the Seabank Temperance Hotel, Mortimer Street, Blackpool, at 10 p.m. on Saturday evening next, after my show at the Winter Garden Theater. At that time, I will be happy to tell you something about myself. And to hear in return something about you. Oh, I'm going to meet him. I'm going to meet Max Collodi. All day that Saturday I spent in front of the mirror at the boarding house where I was staying. But powder and lip rouge, used discreetly, of course, could not make me look 23 again. All the makeup in the world couldn't keep me from looking 42. I spent hours of agony before I could make up my mind what to wear. In the end, I knew there was no hope of looking like the snapshot. And I blessed Max for suggesting that the room be dim and that the interview last only 5 minutes. At 10 minutes to 10, I was walking up and down in a dark place near his hotel, waiting. It was the longest 10 minutes I had ever spent in my life. I glanced at my watch. 2 minutes to 10. I put pushed open the swinging door of the hotel and walked up to the reception desk.
Yes, lady?
Could you tell me the number of Mr. Max Collodi's room, please?
They're number 7 on the first floor. Stairway to your left.
As I walked across the lobby, I felt his eyes on my back. I mounted the stairs, taking care not to trip over the worn carpet. I dabbed at the tip of my nose with a small scented handkerchief. At a roses from Boots at 4 and 6 the bottle. Number 5. Number 6. Number 7. Oh, God. Help me.
Won't you come in?
I was sitting behind a large mahogany table. Even in the dim light, I could not mistake him. He was so handsome. He didn't get up. He just inclined his head in the brusque, slightly stiff way I knew so well. It was the bow with which he acknowledged applause in the theater.
Dear lady, pray sit down.
Thank you. I didn't know what to say. What was there to say? To gain time, I quickly glanced around the room. An ordinary room with flowered wallpaper. There was a bed, a wardrobe, a small chest of drawers. Rolled grotesquely on a chair to Max's left was the dummy George. So lifeless there in the half-light. Mr. Collodi.
Max Collodi at your service.
Mr. Collodi. My voice sounded thin and false. Not myself speaking at all, but someone else. Someone else in my body. Trembling. Aching. Sickened stomach. And suddenly this swept into me as I sat there. A terrible and overwhelming desire. I wanted to touch Max Collodi. Just to touch him once. To touch his hands, his forehead, his blue-tinted jaw. It was a craving so terrible I could not resist. I got up. I stood for a moment, staring wildly, hardly breathing. I walked quickly around the table.
Madam, what are you doing?
I touched him on the cheek and... he toppled sideways and fell from his chair. George was standing up on the chair, his hideous face twisted with rage. And as I stared, I realized that the dummy George was a living creature. And that what I had loved was nothing but wood and claws and glass. At last, I had met Max Collodi, the ventriloquist. I stared at the dummy on the floor, the beautiful staring face I had loved so much. One eye was gone and sawdust poured from his head, but it still smiled. And all the time that misshapen dwarf was weeping. That unlovable thing, the real Max Collodi, who had worked the movements of that handsome mouth with strings and wires. How could he have hoped to get away with it? He who was as hungry for affection as I was. I started to run from the room. My foot trod on something round and hard. I stooped and picked it up, then ran screaming from the hotel. It was the glass eye. The glass eye of the thing on the floor. The glass eye that rests now as a terrible relic on its black velvet pants on my mantelpiece.
Now that is a story. Tell me honestly, did you ever think that the real ventriloquist would turn out to be just a dwarf? And that the big handsome man was really only the dummy? Well, it had me surprised. That's what we call a switch ending. And it's the kind that would have made O. Henry proud indeed. Loreen Tuttle is to be warmly congratulated for her fine acting as Julia. And Byron Kane deserves a bow for his portrayal of Max Collodi, both sizes. Claude Sweeten, as always, composed and conducted the music. Jerome Lawrence and Robert E. Lee wrote and directed this pre-radio adaptation of John Keir Cross's The Glass Eye. Our thanks also to choreographer Jerome Robbins, who chose The Glass Eye as this week's favorite story.